stop coming up at 4 o'clock because the worship team, everybody has to come in set up for tonight. And so because of that, we can't run over at all. So I'm going to go ahead and start right now. So if you people regathering here. Amen. Okay, so one little thing I want you to add to that. Michael's lecture, he was talking about the left brain and the right brain. The word that's missing in there, in order to keep yourselves from sounding silly when you explain this to somebody else, is dominant. So it's right brain dominant, left brain dominant. Anybody who studies the brain will tell you that after age 4, both sides of your brain are involved. The question for us is who's in charge? So if you say, well, the left brain does this and the right brain does that, everybody who's studied a brain who's older than 4 years of age that isn't badly traumatized will say, well, that's not really how it works, because there's when one part of the brain is involved, the other brain will be doing something, right? But dominant is the word you need to know in order to keep this on the understandable level with people who've been studying the brain. The other thing that I thought I would add is last week's research. Someone studying millennials came up with the statistic that 22% of the millennials report having no friends. None. Zero. No friend. So, yeah, they've got lots of social media, but when it comes to a friend, 22% will say they have none. So we're talking about a group identity. You can't have a group identity and have no friend. I just can't. It's not compatible. So we're looking at a world who's rapidly going into relational crisis. And actually, for all kinds of reasons, I had a chance to talk to the 72 Christian colleges and University of Asia, and their question was the effect of the internet on their college students. And so the odd thing is, because of the internet, they know people and things from everywhere. So they're more widely aware than any culture before, and they can't answer the question of who my people are. The wide exposure has changed the sense of having a local people, because that isn't quite right. But the wide exposure has not produced a replacement people. So there's all these people I can contact on the internet, but at an emotional identity level, none of them has the right to tell me who I am. And that's my people have the right to tell me who I am. They have the right to tell me who I should be. They have the right of telling me when I'm not being one of us. That isn't there in this new environment. And so consequently, the things that we require to develop Christian character, which are people whose eyes light up to see us and identify us as themselves as having an attachment with us that's eternal, and therefore we can talk to each other about who we really are, that's missing. And 22% of them have like zero people who are able to give them that kind of content. This is a crisis. Culture as we know it is not going to survive that kind of force. So we now need somebody who is willing to look at people and see in them somebody that they love, even though that person looks back at you blankly, or at best blankly, and at worst thinks of you as someone either to exploit or attack. Who is it that would love the people who have no people? Well, there's only one religion in the world whose leader says, I'm here to love my enemies, and you're to follow this example. So, in order to love your enemies, you basically have to know how to get out of enemy mode. That's what I'm going to talk about this hour. So, learning how to get out of enemy mode is the essence of learning how to engage people when they're our enemies, and when we begin to feel like they're our enemies too. Now, enemy mode, you have to understand, is extremely common. All right? When my wife is not listening to me, and I'm feeling like now I'm all alone, I'm talking to a wall, there's a real high chance of my brain going into enemy mode. I'm not feeling connected with her. Now, logically and all of that, I wouldn't, you know, say, well, now this is my enemy. But I begin to treat her as though she were. I watch this all the time. If you want to watch enemy mode, I just suggest that you go to either Walmart or one of those stores and walk down the aisle and watch people interacting. And watch them when they think someone isn't listening to them, like their kids. You're not paying attention. You're not doing, you know. And watch the kids when they think their parents aren't listening. And you will watch enemy mode operating all the time. You can't go down an aisle without running into enemy mode during a busy session. You know, it's real easy to see on the freeways, too. When people don't react to someone cutting in front of them as though they were one of my people, and I want to make sure they do so safely. You know, these are all things that we have. They're very, very common in our life. We never identify them as our brain has now got into enemy mode. So the first thing we want to do is be able to identify it. Now, let me just roll back the tape a minute and go. What I said to you, the most important thing is to learn how to get out of enemy mode. I suspect most of you didn't hear that. I suspect most of you heard the most important thing is to not get into enemy mode. A completely different issue, how to not get into enemy mode versus learning how to get out of enemy mode. Can you see how that would be different? You know? Most of us, when we're trying to deal with anger, are trying to figure out, how do I keep people from getting angry at me? Or how do I keep myself from getting angry? Not how do I use angry to get back to relationship. So once we fall into the puddle, you know, we've been trying to stay out of, now we're stuck. We don't know how to get out of it. But the brain has state-dependent learning. So when I was learning to scuba dive, we spent a little time learning how to put our masks on. That was like a 3-minute lesson. We spent a whole lot more time learning what to do when your mask had gotten full of water and was coming off underneath. How to get out of the problems that happen when water gets in your mask. That we practiced over and 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 over again, because no one really cared that much if you knew how to put your mask on. The question is, do you know how to get it cleared when it was full of water? That's the problem you actually have to be able to be pretty good at solving. And so this is what we're talking about, enemy mode. If you want to learn how to get out of enemy mode well, it helps you a lot more if you go into enemy mode 200 times a day than if you go out to enemy mode once a week. Right? You'll have 200 chances to practice one way. You'll have one chance a week the other way. And so, frankly, the more often you can notice that I'm going into enemy mode or you're in enemy mode with me, the more we notice it, the more frequently it happens, now we can start the actual useful self-rescue. How do I get out of this enemy mode so that when I'm in enemy mode, see, if you're underwater and your mask is flooding, you're highly motivated to get that problem solved if you knew how. There's no reason, you know. All you would say, if I know how I'd get out of this. And enemy mode, does anyone here remember actually having enjoyed being in it? Right? It's an obnoxious state, really. I mean, here's some of the things that happen. The most characteristic thing about enemy mode is I feel alone. I alone am left of all God's prophets. I am the only one here who cares about what's happening right now. No one is listening to me. I remember one time the particular trauma in my childhood, just because the really violent place that I had grown up, always left me feel like I'm alone, there's no one going to help me out. And so my wife had a way of triggering me into that state. And when we did, you know, I'd feel like I'm all alone, no one's on my side, no one's listening to me. I'd start saying things like that. And she says, no, I'm here and I care about you. And she would argue with me about that, and I would feel more and more and more and more alone because you're not getting it. So one day, I think because the Holy Spirit was there, I said to her, you know, if you could just be with me a little while I feel all alone, I might learn that I'm not. And I remember how she just sort of stunned looked at me. And she thought to herself, I could do that. So she just sat and listened to me talking about while I was all alone and no one cared and there was no one in the world with me and all that, knowing, of course, it wasn't true. But I'd never had anyone sit and watch me and be there and care about it. And when I learned that in my enemy mode, I'm all alone, it actually learned there's a way out of this. I don't have to stay here. And really, it was like one time through with that. And I don't recall now in the last probably 5 or 6 years since that happened that I've ever dropped back into that same state and stayed there. Now, I'll come through my mind, you know, something will go wrong and I'll feel for a moment like I'm all alone and no one cares and I remember what that feels like. But it's like, well, yeah, but you don't have to stay here. That's no longer the final truth in the universe, you see. It's that, learning that we need to do with each other. So when we hear the person come in and say, God doesn't exist and doesn't care and I'm all alone and no one helped me out and all that other sort of stuff, if we sit to arguing with them about the existence of God and the 47 proofs and all that other thing, we stop sharing that moment of, you know, God now feels like your enemy, doesn't he? Yeah, and you shouldn't be alone in that state. I'm going to be with you in that. Those are the ways that we begin to learn our way out of it. But now, to do that, we have to begin to recognize when we're in enemy mode. So the first thing I'm going to say is, you need to make this part of your conversation. So when did you feel all alone? Well, the most common thing nowadays is you left your cell phone someplace. And you're that panic that sets in, I'm all alone, what if I get a flat tire? I haven't had a flat tire in 37 years, but, you know, I might have one now because my cell phone isn't in, you know, with me. That sense of being all alone, that's the beginning of that enemy mode feeling of the world is now my enemy. I have no access to help. There's no one that will be around me. Sometime you might have felt this when you were away from everyone you know, maybe a different culture, a different country. You know, most people who go on missionary trips at some point, usually about 6 weeks in, begin to feel like they are all alone. There's no one here that understands me, that gets me, that's on my side, that would connect with me. If anything went wrong now, there'd be no one to help. That's the feeling of enemy mode. Now, we didn't get there because necessarily we had an enemy with a gun, but we get there because our brain is saying, I am all alone, there is no attachment in the world. No one knows where I am. No one cares what's happening to me now. I am. The essence of enemy mode is an attachment crisis. There's no one attached to me right now that would help. And I can't think of how to overcome that. That's what makes us feel like the world around us is our enemy. Now, if there's someone there that would attach to us and help us, we don't go into enemy mode because we've got friends. We've got allies, we've got someone who cares, someone who's with us in the middle of it all. You ever feel that way at work or some other situation? There's nobody on my side now. No one understands what's happening here. No one stand up for me. No one will back me. You know, something bad is happening. I'm the only one here. I'm going to have to take care of myself somehow or another. I've got to look after number one. You notice how that spirals into the American identity. You know, everyone here is supposed to be self-rescuing. And the problem with self-rescuing is if it really is only yourself that's rescuing you, you can't get out of enemy mode. The way we were actually rescued is by remembering we're not alone. We have a people. And we have a God who's part of our people. And we're not forgotten, even if we might be suffering at this particular point in time. So I would like you to just think to yourself, what are some of the common ways in which you have noticed enemy mode, either in yourself or the people around you or you know, going into a Walmart. But what does it look like? And now think about just one or two words that you would use to describe what it looks like, either in you or someone around you. Tell it to the person next to you. I've seen enemy mode. It looks like this. Give it one or two words. Now, if the other person hasn't had a chance, let them tell you something about how they see enemy mode. All right, and now I'm going to interrupt that process a minute. I saw the conversation start all over the room. And so what I want us to learn from this experience is that it's really quite easy to start talking about it. And if we can begin to just talk with each other conversationally about enemy mode, and when we see it, we end up bringing it to our attention so that it's something that we together notice. So I gave a sermon something like this a few months ago at my church, and I play on the worship band. So when we came in for church, we were setting up for the worship, and one of the members came in and said, "Hey, how are you doing today?" He said, "I am in enemy mode." Yeah. And we understood each other right then. Yeah, it's like, I thought to myself, it's probably not the first time. And I said to him, "You've come to the right place." And really, almost as fast as that, it was over. Right? You've come to the right place. This is where we come when we're in enemy mode, so that we are understood by other people who know how to help us out of that because they're glad to be with us. That is really what we begin to do. So when we say, "You know, last night when I was getting cranky, I was getting in enemy mode. I was feeling like I'm all alone." Just wanted to mention that today because you probably noticed it too. That's part of what I want to learn to get out of. So if we can start talking about the times I'm in enemy mode, we've got something on our table that we can talk about. If we talk about it with each other. It's not like it's an uncommon experience for human beings, right? If you had a cramp in your foot, you'd say, "Oh, I got a cramp in my foot," right? We got an enemy mode cramp in our brain. We ought to be able to say, "I got an enemy mode cramp in my brain," you know? The cramping thing is not letting me act like what I want to do. And of course, the reason we don't do that is because now we don't have any idea what to do next. But we actually do notice it at some level. Right? We are not happy with ourselves or the situation around us. How much better to just begin with a conversation like that? Now, how do we get into enemy mode? Well, the first thing is we get into mode when we feel there's no one to share our life. So if you grew up with people who were not particularly interested in sharing your life, your brain sort of defaults into enemy mode at the slightest appearance that no one's interested right now. So I know some people, simply if I'm not looking at them, I happen to look down or away when they're saying something, their brain immediately goes into enemy mode and says, "You're not interested." Well, it's not that I'm not interested, but you know, you're standing right in front of the door. The sun's very bright behind you. I'm not looking that direction. You know, it's just, you know. But their brain is already set to go that way because there's so much wealth of experience that says the world by and large is made up of people that aren't interested in me, so any sign makes me drop into enemy mode. Well, now there's somebody who's going to have a lot of chances to practice. Right? So we don't rebuke them for dropping into enemy mode. Say, "Thank you for telling me. Yeah, this is a good chance to practice getting out of that right there. You know, what would it take for you to know that I'm interested in you? That'd be an interesting conversation. It's not particularly difficult to think about, right? Except that we never thought of talking about it before. See, when I became a father in my early 20s, and I had no idea how that worked. But I noticed that all the young mothers were busy talking with the other young mothers about they didn't know how it worked either. But they would say, ooh, that kid makes me so mad. I just feel like slapping him sometimes, you know? And I thought, you know, if I ever told anybody that, I'd probably get locked up. Not that I haven't felt that way, but the young mothers had a chance to talk about how unlike young mothers they felt and how little they knew how to do when this or that or the other happens. They pooled their ignorance, and out of which emerged eventually a sense that we're not alone and we can solve this together. So I remember the day that I decided, you know what? I am going to approach another young father and I'm going to ask him something, just as though we men talked about it. And I remember asking him something about you. I said, well, you know, I don't know how to be a father when this and this and this happens. And he looked at me with this totally perplexed look on his face, like, can we talk about this? to this day, that look on his face, like, no one in my life has ever brought up such a topic, and I have no idea who I am or what I'm supposed to do right now. It's like, is this in our identity anywhere? Now, I'd thought about it enough that I said, yeah, I know we guys never talk about this, but I see the young mothers talking about it, and I just thought we ought to be as good as they are about figuring it out. What do you think? I said, you know, if I wasn't good at fishing, I would ask you, what are the fish biting on, and what kind of lures you use and stuff like that. I said, when my kids aren't paying attention, I have no idea what lures to use. Do you? No, I don't. So it started a good conversation. I mean, it didn't only go so far because we had very little material to operate with, you know. Would have done better with lures or gas mileage, but nonetheless, once it became part of the thing that we could talk about, it's amazing how much we'd figured out in 6 months, right? Once this becomes something you can talk about, it's amazing what all of you, if I told you nothing else, would figure out about enemy mode, how it operates and how to get out of it, because we can just talk about that as something that happens. So someone to share our life can end right now. I often tell people, just tell the person what you would say if you walked out the room and were going to talk to somebody else. Because we know what we're going to say when we walked out the room. We just never think we could say it in the room. So we move that in, and we never think about it actually while we're still in the room. We walk out the door and we think, well, I'll say this. You can go back in. Walk back in the room. You say, you know what I didn't think to say when I was in here? This is what it is. Oh, well, no one's ever said that before. It's a brand new topic. We could actually learn about this. This kind of issue could exist among us. We don't have to tear each other up. We have to learn about it together. Another thing that makes us get into enemy mode is weak bonds. That is, you'll stay connected to me as long as it's nice and you like it. But as soon as anything goes wrong, you're out of here, or I'm out of here, we're going to dump each other. So the idea that if we expect weak bonds, no one is going to stick with it. We will, in fact, not get into the things around enemy mode because they usually feel a little stronger in our hearts. And we think if we bring this up to somebody, they're just going to not want to have anything to do with us again. And so we have to begin to build stronger bonds within the church. Now, what I'm going to talk about tonight in the sermon, actually 12 things based on neuroscience that help us build stronger bonds. So how would that look if we did that in church? We don't have time to go into that right now. Another thing goes in is intense or shameful experiences. So if we have something and our bonds have even been normal strength, but something really, really intense happens to us, something really bad, and we think, if you knew this, you wouldn't listen. You wouldn't be able to hear it. You wouldn't be able to, you know, you'd leave me and I'd be alone. Trauma is basically when your brain decides something intense will not be shared by anybody else. You're alone with this one. and it goes into a sort of an enemy mode spiral. The world becomes my enemy if we ever talk about this. There'll be no one on my side. This is unbearable. That's why we call it trauma. It's not unbearable because of how bad it feels. It's unbearable because it will sever every known relationship, and I will be alone. And once we learn that it cannot sever, nothing will separate me from the love of Christ. And we learn that because his people are demonstrating it for us. Trauma is incredibly easy to resolve. But your brain has to learn that you will not be abandoned if you bring this up. So the idea will not solve trauma. The building the bonds that don't abandon you, that will resolve, give it the possibility of resolving trauma. And then finally, we're all born predators. And you've probably heard this before from me. But the human brain is born in predator mode. Predator mode is what enemy mode is about. They're the same. Means predator mode means you are there for me to eat, for me to consume. You're not there for me to protect. And so we have to learn to be protectors. It's entirely learned. Compassion isn't entirely learned, which helps us to learn to be protectors. But how to be protectors is entirely learned. You have to tell the children, don't eat everything, because part of it should be there for supper for the other kids in the family, everything like that. Protective stuff is all entirely learned. And so we have to learn together as a community how to be protective. Otherwise, your brain will, by default, always go to enemy mode. If you knew how to be protective and you had some experience of that, your brain doesn't drop into enemy mode, because actually being protective is a whole lot more rewarding than enemy mode. When you get done with enemy mode, the best you can do is look back and hope you didn't damage something that was important to you. You ever seen that with anger? Dropped into enemy mode, you damaged something, and then you go back later and go, oh no, I hope I didn't do too much damage to the relationships that matter to me. And you swear to yourself, I'm not going to get into enemy mode again and cause damage, and then your brain pops into enemy mode. You just don't know how to get out of it. So returning to joy, getting out of these things, all this is, we have to practice how to be protective so that I can think to myself, well, you know, I could kick you, but afterwards I'd have to share your pain and rebuild all of that stuff, and that's highly unrewarding to me. I would much rather start by protecting you now. And what I really am maddest at you about is you do not appear to be on my side and want to solve this very important problem. So I said, you know, I'm drifting into enemy mode right now, pretty intensely. It would help me a lot to know if you would like to solve this problem with me at some point, even if we don't know how to solve it right now. You say to me, yeah, okay, I can see you're getting into enemy mode. I'd like to protect you and us too from any damage from that. Now, if this is what's running through your fast track, it's going to go much faster than you could ever put it in words. All of what I just said there will go by in less than a sixth of a second. It'll go by in that look that we shoot each other and go like, yeah, this is it right now, and we'd like to have this turn out better. All of that happens before I've said my first words about it, because we've been practicing identifying that we want to be protective when either one of us is in enemy mode. We want this to end well. So how do you practice that? Well, you practice that in the little tiny little enemy modes that are so insignificant, you know, that you know they can turn out right. So that after we've practiced this with the little ones, your brain goes, I have some degree of faith and hope that if this got to be a bigger one, we could still handle it. Right? You're building experience making progress. So I took lifeguarding class. One of the first things the instructor said is, do not jump into the water unless you're sure that you and the other person can get out. Right? We don't need two people to drown. So you need to build your skills to where when it's this bad, we are pretty sure we've built the skills to pull ourselves out of it. Otherwise, go back and, you know, go to your corners, do some damage control. I'm too far into enemy mode right now to be able to pull myself out of it. But we've gotten some experience along the way, which makes me fairly confident that by tomorrow I'll have cooled off enough to do it. And I remember the night that I first said to my wife, you know, I don't think we can work this out tonight. We're both pretty upset and mad about it, and we don't have any answers for what's upsetting us. But I sure would like to go to bed joyful with you. Do you mind if we give this problem to Jesus to hold overnight? I'm sure he won't forget what it is, and probably we won't either. But I'd much rather know that you and I are determined to help get his help figuring this out tomorrow, and we can go to bed tonight, not stay up all night and fight, and have a good relationship and be in better shape for tomorrow. And she looked at me and said, that makes sense. Well, that was really all I actually needed to go to bed without enemy mode. You know, like, of course, this is a better plan. And really, I don't think since that day again, we have gone to bed mad with just that silence between us, you know, that says, you know, this, you know, I am totally alone. I'm going to spend the night alone with the enemy less than 2 feet away. And you know, I'm not sure I want to close my eyes. I love that sense of camaraderie and that laugh, you know, like we can identify this kind of a state. You see, we all get there so easily. And so that means that we are learning to be protective even when we do not yet know how. And we're assuring each other that even if I can't figure it out, we have a friend. We have Jesus, and we probably have some human friends that don't know any better about this than we knew about being mothers and fathers when we started out. But if we talk with them together and we enlist the help of God, something is going to help come along. We don't know what it is, but in the meanwhile, we do not have to stay in enemy mode, right? Perhaps we'll call it seeker mode. We're seeking the answers to our identity. Who does God want us to be under these conditions right here? And so the way that we get out of enemy mode is we have to practice relational joy enough that our brain knows it exists and that it can be found. If you've never tasted someone being glad to be with you, you cannot get out of enemy mode, because if there's no glad to be with you, the world's your enemy, right? So the more we practice together as church, as families, as others, being glad to be together, so that, you know, there's a bunch of people who are glad to be with me, at least when nothing is going wrong. That's the water that Michael was talking about floats up the logs and the log jam. It raises things to a level where stuff can move around that couldn't have moved before, because there's simply a rising level of joy in my life and in our life. Now, to kind of make it clear, every culture in the world I've ever studied has more restrictions on joy than they do on sexuality. More taboos about joy and who you can smile at than they have about who you can have sex with. It's so powerful that it's highly regulated. So I know that in Southern California, if I go to the airport and I go into the men's room, I am not to smile at any of the other gentlemen in there on either side. That will not go well. Unless I'm glad to be with you is going to go really... Mm-mm. Do not even try that. Now we all laugh about that, but where I grew up, there was a saying... in Spanish, colombiano no orina solo, which means that no guy will go to the bathroom by himself. Well, there were no bathrooms there. We would line up against the wall. If anyone had to take a pee, all the guys were up against the wall and on the street, because there are no public bathrooms. And so we all went together, and we'd laugh and smile at each other and giggle and carry on. It was like the social moment in the day there, where all the guys were up against the wall. It sounds pretty gross in this society. Can't imagine it going on, but other cultures don't have, you know, it's just the understanding of when you could smile is so tremendously different from one of those settings to another, you know. One of the first things that shocked me when I was in Colorado is I'm used to hiking in California, right? And when I was out on the trails, if women came along, they all made sure they did not smile at me, and at best they tried to act like I didn't exist, unless they had two very large dogs. Then they would smile because they've got dogs. ah, this is killer and this is tooth, you know, and I guess they knew I had a fear of dogs, but whatever it was, the first thing that shocked me in Colorado is every woman of whatever age that came running by me on the trail, by me, smiled and said hi, and how are you doing? It was like, okay, the rules are very, very different over here. Over here, there's apparently enough of a lack of predatory behavior that it's, you know, it's allowed to do this. And I don't watch at what age are little girls no longer allowed to smile at everybody that they run into? Right? And there's a rule in this, and different cultures will do it differently. So all of these things say that if predators are around, they're going to be attracted by joy. Right? We know that that attracts everybody, and we don't want to take a chance on attracting predators. So we bring all these rules into church, and we do treat each other all as predators, but if we're actually supposed to learn how to protect each other, we should be learning safe ways to have joy in here that don't lead to predatory behavior, because we're learning also to be protective. You can't just release joy and find it safe. If you release joy in church, every predator in your town will be in here before long. In fact, one of the things we found out, one of the reasons I wrote the book on narcissism right now, is every joyful community I've ever studied was destroyed by a narcissist. They were just attracted by the joy, and they were going to have all of these joyful people for lunch. As long as that many people that are glad to be together, they should all be glad to be with me, the narcissist. And once that happens, then now it's a very unsafe environment, and none of the groups knew how to be protective against narcissism. So if you can't protect against the people that will exploit your joy, the only thing you can do is disband the community, which is what happens over and over and over again. So we have to not only consider that joy is the most powerful thing that you could release, but every culture has had to figure out either how to restrict it to very, very few, but they've not known how to be protective and invite Jesus' presence into it so that we are becoming protectors of the joy around us. And by the way, if you've ever tried the difference between eating the joy around you and protecting the joy around you, I'll tell you that protecting the joy around you has a lot of eternal benefits that eating the people that are joyful simply doesn't have. We have something so good to offer to other people, but we must be the people who are teaching others how to be protective, how to build joy, how to protect joy as a community, how to make it safe to have joyful, in particular joyful girls. The Journal of Psychohistory studied all the histories that they could across the world and trying to predict what had made for very good cultures and what had made for terrible cultures. And the answer that they came up with was the predictor of what kind of culture you have is how joyful the girls are. Joyful girls grew up to have joyful boys and boys and girls for children. Joyful children were highly creative. But what made women joyful is the way that women and children, babies in particular, were treated in that culture. And if it was painful to grow up to be a woman and it was painful to be a baby, then you had a hopeless bunch of girls. And those cultures, in as little as two generations, went from being some of the lead cultures to some of the backwaters of society. And they said furthermore that the number one effect on making hopeful girls in the history of the world, and these are secular writers, had been the arrival of Christianity. Because when Christianity arrived, people stopped infanticide. They stopped killing babies. Christians just didn't put up with it. But they said Christianity has not done very well at moving past that point. And I think that's what we have to consider. We really have to, yes, we should protect babies, but if we can't raise joyful girls, we can't make the rest of the trajectory joyful and relational. If we can't be kind of relational people, that those who care about relationships feel like we have come to the place where not only are relationships sacred, but they're practiced and improved, And we learn to see in each other what God sees there and bring that out in each other. So we became more than any human society by itself could produce, because we not only had the human eyes, but we had the eyes of God looking for what he had created from before the foundation of the world, calling that into existence and helping it to grow safely there. That's the kind of society that I believe would be contagious. It would change the reputation of the church in the world. It would change the way that we interact with each other. And part of it is learning how to stay in that relational mode so that we can hear God. But the other part is that we have to form attachments with each other. Because until it gets to the point where whatever happens to you is something I'm going to share, there's nothing really to stop us from being predators. See? We're stopped from predatory behavior because we know we're going to share the outcome of whatever's going on. Our society, our culture will insist upon it. So I can't cause you any harm that I'm not going to share, that I'm not going to live through. To me, the biggest example of this is Father Ubald in Rwanda. He's a friend of mine. And he's one of the ethnic minorities that suffered like 1 million people killed in their genocide in Rwanda. Are you familiar with that? It's 25 years ago now, this year. Well, Father Ubald went to Rwanda to teach love. And after 10 years of teaching love, he was Rwandan. They had already killed his father and tried to kill him, which is why he had left the country. But he went back to teach love. After he did that, the members of his own parish tried to kill him. And in his own parish, they killed 45,000 of his parishioners because they were the wrong ethnic group by the other parishioners who were the other ethnic groups. It was the church killing itself. And in a neighboring parish, there was a man who killed, I believe it was 35 members of Father Ubald's family, including his mother. And Father Ubald went back and he said, we have to again form a church out of these people. So those who did the killing must repent and become family for those whose family they killed. And those whose family were killed will have to forgive them until we learn to live as one people. And so if you were to see Father Ubald with the man who killed his mother and the members of their parish and how they have worked through this as a community, they go out to the people and said, we know that you killed the family of so-and-so. And they go to the so-and-so and they say, you know that that was the person who killed your family and we need to restore our faith. We have to become Christians. Because Christians don't kill. And so you have to, must repent and become a Christian. You've called yourself a Christian all these years, but you acted this way. And Christians love their enemies. They don't hold grudges against the people who have tried to kill them. Now, you would think that'd be a pretty high order, wouldn't you? But time after time, the result of the community coming around and saying, we are going to relearn what it means to be Christian until we can love our enemies together. They took the killing parties through 6 months of training, of confession, until they had confessed everything. Then after that, they brought in the victims, family of the victims. And you know, if you didn't confess everything already, the family of the victim is going to make sure that nothing got left out. And it's all going to be forgiven together. And then when it's done, they're brought before the church and readmitted into fellowship, and the church throws a big party, and from that point on the two families live as though they were one family, building that kind of love together with each other. And the result on the community around them is amazement. Now you just think about crime in Southern California or hatred or any other group that you're thinking about and say, if we were the kind of people where that kind of transformation is taking place, would there be some wow of what God can do? Because when you look at these families together now, you look at their face, you see real, genuine joy. Here are people who are glad to be together, each of them having let the other one out of something they thought they could never outlive or get out of. They see God at work once again. And this is the kind of thing that inspires me to think that even here, when our problems are so much smaller, if we invited God in and began to talk about when people feel like enemies, how are we going to deal with these issues? How are we going to see them as God sees them? How are we going to help people actually confess the truth about themselves in terms of what they've done and discover the truth about themselves in terms of who God's calling them to be? That is what has to be happening in the church. We've got the experience, mostly in other parts of the world, that says it happens with people who don't know the science. We know the science that says we know how God designed the brain so that it's actually our group identity that calls us to be something that we weren't before. You see, that's what they've done right. They didn't take these people into individual counseling. They brought them into the body of the church, where the church says we are not the kinds of people that leave our sins unconfessed. We are not the kinds of people who continue to not forgive our enemies. We're not the kind of people who refuse to form attachments to others simply because we have hurt in our lives. We know it's not easy, but we will stay with you till you learn how to do it. That's the kind of community that transforms the things that we don't see being changed here. If you had that kind of community, you could actually invite pedophiles into the church to be changed. Right now we have to screen them out. Because if you bring a pedophile into church, they will have lunch on every victim they can find out. Because nothing's going to change them, it's just going to give them a bigger lunch bucket. The same thing with almost any kind of abuse, including narcissism and leadership. You know, this is the place where narcissists look good. Is until we change who we are to say we're going to form the kind of attachments that won't put up with that. Say we're just not the kind of people that can let you go on living that way. And you know, will that change everybody? The answer is clearly no. Paul says that they went out from us because they were not of us. But we will have given them a chance to become of us, and we will have revealed their hearts if they're not. And that's a different kind of a church. It's hard to imagine really for us what that would be like, because it's hard to imagine even tonight what it would be like to form attachments with people who came here. It's just not what we have in our mind as our culture. And yet I think that's what God is calling us for, teaching us how to do. And so the final thing is, I believe that we have lost our youth primarily on this basis. If you ask them why did they leave the church, they will say they left the church because, in their own words, it failed to transform the character of the people that was there. And I looked around the world and thought, whose character do I like? I like my New Age neighbor and how he was. I like my atheist friend. I like these other people. That character appealed to me a whole lot more. The people that were in my favorite rock group fan club. You know, we liked being with them. These people in church talk about all the good stuff, but their character isn't changing. And so, if it doesn't really change that, why should I put up with all the rest of it? It's a huge load to carry for no good change, right? So I think we need to say, how am I going to let God change my enemy mode? What will make me the antithesis of the hateful Christian that we're portrayed in the media as being? Right. What's going to be different? And it'll start with things like being quite sure that we will never figure out the right thing to do, and that we must share all of our thoughts with Jesus. And even if we're not at all clear of which are thoughts and which are his, mingling those thoughts together as a community will make us into people that none of us knew we could be before. And that's the kind of community that will invite the millennials with 22% with no friends and the rest of them to come back and find out what that's all about. And to me, that's, you know, that's the core. Now, if you start talking about it with the help of the Holy Spirit and Jesus' presence, you will figure out how to do that with no more than what we've talked about today, because it's His intention to make this happen. I'm just telling you that from a brain and a cultural perspective, it can be done. Have some hope, and then start talking with Him about it, and we will be praising the Lord for the outcome. So thank you for your time. And I think we're going to do some Q&A.
Q&A, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want people to come up and talk on the microphone?
We'll just repeat the question probably better.
We can just repeat the question? Okay, that's what we'll do. All right. We're going to take questions and answers. Well, questions, maybe answers. Hopefully answers. So, go ahead. Stand up and ask your question. So the question is, what's the difference between somebody in enemy mode who's complaining? Is that a bad thing for them to do? Isn't that complaining? Like when you say, I'm in enemy mode right now. What's the difference?
Yeah, okay. Well, the difference is whether you have a path out or not. Do you have a path out of enemy mode or not? If I just come around and tell you, you know, you're in enemy mode or I'm in enemy mode, and we've never practiced getting to joy together, then all you'll hear is, here's another thing that's wrong. But if I've built joy with you and I said, I'm in enemy mode, I'd love to get that, I'd like to get out of it, and we have some idea of how to help each other, now you've started a helpful conversation. It's the difference between good and bad shame. Bad shame is just telling you what's wrong with you. Good shame messages is that that's not how we are. We really like to be this way, and I help you to get to a better way of relating to other people, which is why we need to practice starting at the joy end and building joy together enough that when we actually have something go wrong, we can say, oh, well, this isn't nearly as much fun as joy. Let's figure out how to get back here. And if we can't, we've got a people around us that will help us do it, just like the mothers who did not know what to do with their babies got gathered a bunch to do it. So these are not things that should be attempted by yourself. Otherwise, we'll always get stuck someplace, right?
And I would say, you know, the Book of Psalms is a good place to go to see where there's complaint and lament. That's redemptive. So, you know, the psalmist would pour their complaint out to God, but then the psalms usually have some kind of an intervention of God's love that then turns somehow the complaint into praise. And so there's got to be some space for the lament, some space for saying what is actually happening rather than trying to just repress it. Okay, let's talk afterward. I'll try to,
Okay. Well, I'll add one other little story to this, which is helpful. Now, my wife and I both went to therapy class when we were I was getting my PhD, and she audited all the classes that Fuller had to offer at the same time. We went to see family therapists and all kinds of therapists, and we learned all about communication therapy and how to talk about everything like that. And when it was all said and done, we had all these communication tools, and she would come to me and say, Jim, we have a problem, and my stomach would just turn. I go, oh, not this again. And she said, well, we need to talk. And I said, okay, well, how about a week from next Saturday? if we really have to, because what she was actually asking me, and I would ask her, is, will you be the source of my peace? And I knew this was going to be a pretty hard climb, and I was not going to be very successful at it. Because on the other hand, if I tried to do all my therapy things, you said, stop being a therapist with me. So, well, then that takes all my tools. Now I really feel alone. And so she began the Emmanuel process. And so she would talk through with Jesus in the Emmanuel process until she had peace. Then she would come to me and say to me, Jim, would you like to hear how I got my peace about something? And I would immediately say, let me get my cup of coffee. I'd come up and read it to me. And so part of the thing we have to do as cultures, we have to learn that it's not the talking through the problem that we're talking about. It's knowing that the person that we're talking with knows the resources. So that if you say to somebody, I can't get my peace back, I'm in enemy mode, it's useless unless they know how to get someone out of enemy mode. You say, oh, well, perfect. You told me about it. Now we're going to pull in all the resources that we have in our community to help you out of it so that neither one of us gets stuck. So what we want to really do as a community is to talk about this long enough that we start to learn how to do it, and we also start to learn when this is a bigger enemy mode than I know how to pull myself out of. But can I at least connect with Jesus and get my peace back? Well, it's very interesting, when Jesus gets your peace back, you're not in enemy mode. So that's, you know, that's one way. I mean, all these tools that we have, we develop them as a community. Then when we say to somebody, here's where I am, we're telling them because we already know they know some paths back to help us with. Otherwise, communicating about it only puts us both in a stuck mode. So we can't get there too fast. We need to practice these skills together. And then you can say, oh yeah, can you help me right now? And go, ah, you came to the right place.
Okay, Professor Bill, you had a question.
I'm sure there's not a simple answer to this question. Maybe not even one answer, but I want to open up the issue. You talked about how the joy attachment is stronger than even sexual drive or even survival. In light of that, extramarital affairs develop where detachment forms. It's strong and it gives joy, like the ministry you mentioned. It's strong, it gives joy. It was more joy to him than all of his ministry. There's that attachment, joy attachment, but also sexual, erotic. What's the pastoral counsel for that? You just tell the couple, you've got to cut this off completely and separate them. Or do you say, is there a way to transform this into an honorable relationship? Is it either or how do you pastorally deal with those kind of relationships?
You want to repeat the question or do you want to answer it?
The question is about how emotional affairs happen between people that are inappropriate, but at the same time we want to attach with people, and so, you know, it can be eroticized. The attachment gets eroticized, and then what do you do if it does? Do you separate people entirely from each other, or find a redemptive way to bring something good out of it?
Yeah, and that's one of the really succinctly placed questions that actually has a remarkably easy answer. I was working with a Catholic order in Canada in which they had put a complete ban on all forms of smiling, because so many of, if anyone developed a smiling relationship with someone else within the order, sooner or later it becomes sexualized. Now, because they go to confession, they typically confessed it early, you know, before it completely blew up. But the end result then was they had to move people to different continents and stuff like that, so they'd never see each other again, which creates a certain amount of attachment pain and brings low joy, and the order was getting increasingly depressed. But here's the interesting thing, that your brain has two attachment mechanisms. One is the group attachment or family attachment, which is three or more people at a time, typically three. The family attachment, three-way joy, almost never becomes eroticized and is almost in every condition that where God's presence is there, safe to develop. two-way joy, if you're over 13, will always become eroticized. It doesn't matter whether you're the same gender or other genders. If you keep it just between the two of us, that is a dangerous element. So if you have a community where it's not safe to have joy with people, what will end up happening is people will keep it private. That's your guaranteed best path to blowing up. If you have a place where I'm beginning to enjoy you and we need to get other people involved in this so we build a community of joy around what's any spark that starts, let's build a community of joy so that everyone is happy with this. Now you've got a completely different growth pattern that'll take place. And that's actually very self-regulating within a Christian community. And so you'll find that most of our exercises and the 19 skills include forming two-way joy bonds, but also forming three-way joy bonds. And almost all of our exercises that we have for communities are three-way joy bonds. They're safe to build in any kind of a community structure. It's getting a little technical, but the answer is there is a very clear way out, and we've not found the same trouble with the three-way joy bonds. I thought it was very nice, though, to acknowledge that, 10 years ago? You were studying telling stories within group identity cultures and how that worked and how it worked well. And I attended your discussion group, and out of that is where we as a life model people identified how do you tell stories and underline the important things and do this to build a group identity and to tell these powerful stories. So the actual source from missionary background and working is sitting among us, and I just wanted to acknowledge your contribution to what we're doing here
today. Thank you, Bill. Woo. Yes, ma'am.
All right, so you want to repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is about the need that singles have for attachment, and that it's kind of hard in our culture for singles to get that in church cultures.
All right, my first observation, at least in the Western culture, is almost the only legal way to get joy is either through children or through your spouse. And so the problem is much larger than just getting together singles to build joy with each other. Because what that does effectively is it cuts singles out of the multi-generational community of the church. But since we only have one acceptable way to build joy, and that is you find your marital partner or you've got your kids, that pretty much eliminates everyone, and the problem is you bring a single person in, anyone starts creating joy with them, everyone else gets jealous, they cut it out, you feel really odd. Because of our set of restrictions on how joy can be built. So yes, we could put singles together. We are also doing that with people in recovery, so recovery people can build joy with other recovery people, but they can't come up to the main room and join the church. And a lot of churches, we've got these special interest groups. You can be glad to be together, but you're not part of the multi-generational community of the church. Some of this comes back to I guess the prettiest way to put it is the world seems afraid of powerful women. And it's probably, if you want to get attacked, the best way to be attacked is to come across as a powerful woman. The church is not the only place that it's hostile to them, but how do you actually incorporate life-giving, power within women in the structure of the church. How does that apply to single people? And all of a sudden you realize we do not have a very coherent relational structure here that will accommodate almost any kind of growth. And until some of that changes, it's going to be very painful to be anybody who we're afraid of because of, you know, whatever group you represent. So I think we've got some real difficult questions to answer that are produced by culture, because we're going to have to be something different than what culture is producing, or we won't have this kind of vibrant community, and we won't have hopeful women. And what you're saying is, I'm not all that hopeful right now. And we need to look at that and go, yeah, that's true. I can see why you wouldn't be that hopeful. Mm-hmm. And something needs to be done differently about forming attachments so that the people who are best at attachments get every chance to do that and build church in church. This is the enhanced environment where if you've got anything to bring, bring it on down, because this is where it's going to grow. That kind of attitude will get you out of the ghetto you're in.
I also just want to mention, if you want more insight into the nature of attachments gone right and attachments gone wrong, Jim gave a lecture, a message, it was more than a lecture, at our annual conference, and it's going to be on JoyStream for free very quickly, very soon, if it's not already up and there. And that's a great message where you go into more depth on attachment in general. Yes, Dr. Victoria?
Yes, Vicky Orr.
Vicky.
My question is this. When you spoke Hurst Hour this morning, I think it was you, said, or maybe it was you, Dr. Waller.
It's good when you don't know the difference.
Question, like, you can both answer. When we are completely transformed, when we step up to glory, except we keep our brain, does that mean that the full potential of our brain comes into reality?
Great question. I don't know. I'm thinking that the glorified human body, you know, that Jesus is the prototype of, I think it's going to go to the next levels, you know, of possibilities of what the brain is going to be doing, you know. So it's a great question. Jimmy, have thoughts?
Well, the hint that we get at that, because the Bible really tells us very little about what the next level is going to be look like in our maturity. We're having enough trouble getting through the six levels we've got down here, and if you know we're not really pretty far along, it'll make no sense what's going on up there. For instance, the no marriage thing, you know, and we're all going to be in this eternal family and the rest of that. But you notice that when Saint John is transported up to heaven, and he begins to weep uncontrollably because things are really, you know, it sounds hopeless up there. By the way, notice that there's weeping going on in heaven. The promises about there being no more tears are for the new heaven and the new earth. Right now, they weep with us in heaven. And that's what that passage, that's why there's saints under the throne going, how long, oh Lord, how long? Because they're in hopeless despair up there. But they're not alone, and so they continue to stay relational with God who's suffering with us down here. The witnesses around us are engaged in what we're going down through down here, and there's a lot less denial going on up there about how difficult it is down here than we currently portray. But one of the elders comes to him to explain and teach him what's going on. So that tells me that in heaven, the expectation is that we're going to be learning.
Yes.
And that means that while the potential of our brain is unlocked, part of that means we're going to be learning machines for the entire eternity. It does not yet appear what we're going to be like. Mm. But this kind of learning, this kind of expanding, this kind of becoming more than we were before is a non-ending process. And it's going to be glorious. That's how I read the text.
Beautiful. Sounds good. Yes, sir.
How would you distinguish the difference between like healthy connection? I weep with those who weep. I'm joy with those who joy. I understand that any harm I bring is also going to affect me. Versus like a codependent, I need you to be okay, so I'm okay. I'm going to try not
The question is about the difference between healthy attachment and unhealthy attachment,
particularly in the area of codependence. Well, the problem with codependence, or let's say the motivating factor in codependence, is that it's trying to prevent hurting. And so the idea that I will do anything to keep the hurt from coming my way is what allows us to then say, you know, I'm being guided by what might hurt me as opposed to being guided by what God is doing. And so you get a completely different outcome, because that's not fear-based guidance versus joy-based guidance. I am going to share your pain because God is here sharing your pain with us, and I'm staying close to him. Will give you a very different outcome from the same pain sharing that you would get if I'm, you know, I'm here picking up that you're in pain and I'm going to try to make it stop some way or another. So the difference between being motivated by that fear of this might hurt and how this is going to get us in trouble versus I'm being guided by God to stay connected with you and him in the middle of this painful situation. The behavior from the outside will look almost identical. You say, what's the difference? Well, the difference is, in one case, God was clearly guiding you how to go through this, how to be there. And the other case, you are not aware of God particularly. You're just trying to make it stop hurting. And again, completely different outcomes. But the behaviors themselves may look almost identical. Yeah. So we're looking at what went on inside, not... Does that make sense? Yeah.
Good answer. I see a hand, yes, over here. This lady, yeah.
I was wondering if you could give us some ideas of what it would look like to be protectors of joy around us.
Okay, the question is, what does it look like to be protectors of the joy around us? Protectors of the joy. I think this is probably where, you know, some advice about dealing with narcissism comes in.
Well, first of all, to say we haven't laid enough foundation in our day on our talk today to actually answer that question in any kind of fundamentally understood way, because the answer lies primarily in the multi-generational community and each of their roles. So how do I protect the joy around me when I'm 2 years old is different than how do I protect the joy around me when I'm 6 years old, different than how do I protect the joy around me when I'm 14 years old, different than what I do when I'm 27 years old, different than what I'm going to do when I'm 67 years old. And because there are different levels in that multi-generational community, all of which are learning a different part of the protection process. So without being able to say that, the simplest place to start is make it an open discussion. Does this joy feel safe or not? And if it doesn't, why not? And we start talking about that, we'll pretty soon figure out why this joy does or doesn't feel safe, and how to become protectors of the joy will develop out of that. So, you know, and I'm talking about this discussion in the manual abiding lifestyle. Like, we're going to talk about this with each other, with God's presence right here. We're going to talk about this until we have a sense of peace that God's guiding us. You do that without the rest of the lecture, you'll figure out all of the details. But I'd like to say one thing that's fun. Scripture makes it very clear that grandparents are, with adult maturity, are free agent joy amplifiers for their whole community. All right? So, you have a, there's an example I like to give. So you have a young woman who's just divorced and she, you know, depressed and she needs joy. Do you want the other young married couples to become the joy amplifiers for her, to go over her house and build joy with her and do something like that? No. Would you like the grandparents in the community to start building joy with this lady and her children? Mm-hmm. And the internal response for us is quite different from the two things. We go like, yeah, let that fly in our community, the better we have, but not that couple. I don't feel good when that old person gets around the kids. So, or gets around the, you know, whatever, keep them out of it. And it could be man or woman. I'm not just, you know, our. So your stomach and your community and your spirit are all telling you, this is safe, this is great, this is good. Don't try that, that's dangerous. When we start looking at those, we will find out. Also, if you ask the question, why is joy so low right here? Well, you'll usually find out why it's not safe to have joy right there. And you're going to have to pray your way into what's going on, which can be anything from demonic to multi-generational trauma to all kinds of things. But as a community, we're looking into it. And again, the safety is in doing this as a community. So, short answer to a much more complex question.
One more question. Yes, sir. Blue shirt. The question is about the fragmentation of our culture right now around different political issues, age groups, ethnic groups, very, very segmented world. How do we build a community that welcomes that diversity and build a what we would call a Hesed community out of that?
Well, obviously we're going to have to give you a somewhat oversimplified answer to that particular issue. However, diversity and celebrating diversity typically increases the fear of one group for another. So when you go into business and you begin to teach about other cultures, you actually, the measurable effect is that the people in that business are more afraid of those other cultures than they were before. The differences begin to reflect threats as opposed to something that we admire or appreciate. Now, drop that off, and let's say it's impossible to form an attachment with sin. Sin is a non-attachable something. The only places where sin and attachment go together is if you're pursuing an attachment that God didn't want. Like, do not lust after your neighbor's wife. You know, then you're forming an attachment that God said, I'm against. In fact, when God prohibits incest, he says, you may not be involved with incest because it's chesed. That's our word for attachment, love. No incest because it's attachment. You're forming an attachment that's going to be permanent where an attachment should never be formed. It's the wrong kind of attachment, wrong place. Don't do it because it's not an undoable. It's not something you undo. So God does prohibit some kinds of attachment. That said, there's no one that he prohibits us from attaching with. Right? We're supposed to love our enemies. There are no prohibited attachments except for demons. Right? Now, so if I am going to form attachments that are impervious to the cultural differences that we have, what God is asking us to form attachments to are the parts of your character that he put in there and has never been called out before and has not been seen by human eye. Right? God looks at you and he says, you know, who you are going to be doesn't look like who you think you are right now. What he needs his church to do is to look at you and go, see, what does God see in you that he wants to call out? I can attach to that even though it's never been seen, but I can't attach to your sinful patterns and go like, well, I want to be part of your sinful patterns. If we do that, every culture is open game because culture does not give us a good enough idea of who we are. And we don't have to attack culture. We just have to go beyond culture and pull out what God is growing in this person's character. And you can interpret that in any cultural pattern you want. You can play that with any rhythm you want and sing it at any volume. I mean, all kinds of cultural flavor. You can put curry powder with it or chiles or whatever you want. That is not what separates us. But what we need as a church to do is not to figure out how to approve of every other human culture. We need to look at each other and see what is God building, and we're going to draw that out with you and let your culture flavor it up the way that it does. And so if we're on that task, diversity is no longer the issue. What we're looking at is a diversity that stands between what God is creating and where we currently are. And we'll have a lifetime's worth of work pulling that out of each other without ever having to worry about whether your worship style or whatever else is a little different from mine.
Okay, Kent, we're done.
All right, why don't we just stand up here to kind of conclude today and just thank the Lord for... Lord, we just so celebrate the wisdom and revelation that you're pouring out at this time in history to lift and to transform the church, your bride, to so you can come back to a bride without spot or wrinkle. And we should say yes to you continuing to transform our minds, to transform our lives as we behold you. And we thank you for these wise men and elders that are teaching us and giving us some pathways to go pursue that. I pray for your grace over everyone in these next hours and wherever we're going, just protection. And thank you for this day in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So just to remind you, if you want to come back, the service here tonight is at 6. Right here in the same room, and Jim is speaking tonight, and then Michael's speaking in the morning at our 10 a.m. service. If there's any of you that could help us a little bit, we have to do some tear down of some of these tables and stuff for the service tonight. We'd love to have a little help with that, and thank you.